Tomás, over here. We'll be leaving from over there, just in front of the blue panel indicating the coastal path.
Hello. Yes, I'm here. I'm so glad, Sira, my friend, that you're here so early today, as I requested, because since the last time we spoke, my head's been in a bit of a mess.
I'm sorry to hear that. But if you think that this walk might do you good, then I'm happy to help.
It'll help, I'm sure. I know that I have to be open to new experiences and finding out new things that aren't related to the history of airships. To be honest, I haven't slept for days. So eager am I to learn all there is to know about fixed-wing aircraft and zeppelins.
Tomás, I know it isn't easy for you to take in so much information in such a short space of time. You'll also find out how many of the predictions you made in your pioneering project on air navigation turned out to be true.
I finished writing it in 1879. How long has it been since then?
More than 140. It was a shame that you never got to publish it.
I can assure you that if I had been rich, my money wouldn't have been put to any other use than building a balloon ship, like the one I designed. But I was just a poor, insignificant man, and it was impossible for me to do anything like that. As I wrote at the end of my manuscript, I am about to turn 81 years of age, and I have given up hope of seeing air navigation. And here I am, learning about the history of aviation in a way I could never have imagined, and discovering a world that is new to me.
And you certainly deserve it, because you, Don Tomás Mariño, a native of Chauvet, land surveyor and teacher, were one of air navigation's pioneers, although such merit was barely recognized outside of the place where you were born. Nothing prevented you from engaging with the preoccupations of your time when the idea of building a dirigible balloon was in its early stages.
Quite simply, for no particular reason. It just came to me, the idea that it might be possible to steer balloons and sail through the air as if it were the sea. I wasn't convinced I was right, because how could anyone know when it hadn't been tested, which was something I never managed to do.
As you know now, after your death, in 1880, the history of air navigation was marked by continuous attempts and notorious failures.
What surprised me most is that 21 more years had to pass until the flight of Count Zeppelin's first dirigible balloon in 1900.
In your project, you proposed using propellers for moving horizontally and vertically, and solutions to guarantee the stability, speed, and direction of the balloons. Today, however, I've brought you here to show you how the landscape that you knew in your youth has changed.
I'm extremely grateful for your offer to guide me through this world today, so different from the one I knew. I'm eager to follow you and hear firsthand everything you think I should know.
Well, let's get started then. But first of all, I'm going to give you some instructions. I'll be telling you which way to go, so make sure you listen carefully. Only stop when I say so, and the rest of the time we'll be walking at a leisurely and constant pace, which you'll only need to adjust if you find you've fallen behind or gone ahead of my instructions, all right?
Understood. I'm ready when you are.
Stand in such a way that the blue panel indicating the coastal path is on your left, all right? From there, walk slowly to the other, bigger panel, just a few meters ahead. Come on. Our walk begins here because it's a fine example of how a coastal landscape can be restored after intensive industrial use. Are you there? Good. We are going to pass in front of several legs, which provide a lot more detail on the factory. But we are not going to take too much notice for the time being. What we are going to do now is to continue walking along this concrete path, which starts on your right and takes us across this esplanade. Come on, let's go.
This flat piece of land would have made a great launch pad if I had ever had the chance to test my balloon ship.
Tomás, it's time for you to put all thoughts of balloons out of your head You need to try to imagine what this place was like when there was a whale processing plant here.
My apologies, Sira. I'll gladly let you tell the story, and I'll be ready to listen. In fact, I was always interested in everything to do with marine mammals. Remember that this entire stretch of coastline had been ideal for whale hunting since ancient times?
That's true. At the time, the exclusive license to hunt whales and own processing plants between the Minho estuary and Estaca de Bares was held by the whaling company IBSA. However, the Massau Canning Company wanted to expand into the whaling industry, so it began to look for a location outside that zone for a new plant. And that's how they found the Bay at Moras.
Well, they certainly had a good eye, as this looks like the perfect place for it, sheltered and accessible.
Now, imagine all of this area taking up with industrial warehouses, just where we began our walk by the roadside, where the offices and the factory laboratory. Then we passed the first warehouse from one side to the other and the curb. We entered the place where the floor was store, which connected directly to the slipway via a ramp where the whales were dismembered. Your attention now, please, because just ahead of you, at the third of the information panels, you'll see that the path branches off. We are going to take the right-hand fork and follow the path that leads towards the sea.
I think it wouldn't have been a bad idea to leave some markings on the ground so that people can have an idea of just how immense these facilities were and see the layout of the warehouses and the machinery.
Well, I prefer to use my imagination. At this moment, we would be passing the three main warehouses. On the right, it had been the cold store, then the meat processing room, and at the end, the drying room, grinder to shred the waste. And here, it had been a large door, which connected with the lifting ramp, which is the only thing that remains.
Sira, would you mind if I stopped here for a moment?
Of course not.
I'm going to sit on that bench on the right for a bit.
From there, you can see the lifting ramp in front of you. When the plant was in service, the ramp was covered with wood so that the wheels could slide along, making it easier to drag them into the warehouses where they were processed. The hunting season began in May and finished in November. The maximum catch on a single day consisted of 12 sperm whales and 2 whales, and the plant only had 2 ships, the Carrumeiro and the Cabo Moras.
Factory from the Carrumeiro. Is anyone listening? Over.
Go ahead, Carrumeiro.
We'll arrive at around 12. We are 3 miles from Roncadoira.
Received, Carrumeiro.
2 whales. We got them strapped to the side of the ship.
Received. We are ready for entry to the factory. Over and out. Everyone get ready. The Carrumeiro is bringing 2 whales.
We got 2 sperm whales with us now. And another 2 tied to buoys out further out, broke in by the Cabo Moras a while ago.
Leave them there for the time being. We're going to bring in the whales from the Carrumeiro first, so the meat doesn't go off.
When the mammals reached the base of the ramp, they were held fast by the tail and lifted mechanically to the processing room. The wheels were brought through here and processed until there was nothing left of them. Come on. If you're rested, then we can continue.
Of course, yes. I'll just stand up. Are we going back the same way as we came?
Yes, we are going to retrace our steps back to the information panel and then take the path that branched off to the right. Now we would be inside the cutting room. Here, the floor could also have been covered with wood to make the animals easier to move. On the right would have been the place where the heads were kept, as well as Harman's cookers. The smell was foul and permeated the entire warehouse.
Sira, when we get to the information panel, do we turn right?
Yes, we are going to follow the path on the right to its end, where it meets the road giving access to the beach. Look, now we are going to pass by where the boiler room was, and then across what could have been the room where the bones were stored.
You have to forgive me if I can't quite imagine as much as I should, but I can't help wondering what those strange orange-colored buildings are, the ones you can see quite far off, on the coast, going towards San Cibrao.
We'll talk about that later. In the meantime, I can at least tell you that the buildings and the breakwaters form a part of the metallurgical complex that was installed here in 1977. This saw the end of the whale processing plant because an aluminium factory was incompatible with a food production plant. So, now we are outside the factory. Let's make a stop, because I think you wanted to say something.
I didn't want to interrupt you, but this place was called Campo do Pazo before the factory was established here. It was used to store pine wood that was shipped by sea to Avilés, Gijón, and Bilbao. The ships anchored on the beach when the tide was in because they were loaded by hand, a job done mainly by women.
Thank you for that. Now, let's move on. We are going to go to the right, then down that road that leads to the beach. Wasn't it here that the festivities to celebrate the day of Our Lady of Carmen were held?
Indeed it was. Not only to celebrate Our Lady of Carmen, but also San Antonio. In Muras, it used to be a two-day holiday. On San Antonio's feast day, there was mass in the church, and then the two images were carried in procession and remained here overnight. The following day, mass was held on the beach. And then the procession continued by boat, with the laying of a garland in the sea in memory of the shipwrecked.
And don't you remember the salting factory that used to be here on the left, just opposite the beach? Before that, more modern-looking house. Some of the locals told me they still remember the salting vats.
Well, I don't know about any salting factory around here. Maybe it was after my time?
Here, the technique known as salting came later. As far as I know, this factory was the only building that existed before 1950s, along with two old fishermen's huts a little further up beside the port.
In my day, fish salting was on the increase, but even more so in other places. I had heard of another breakthrough, which was canning, but I don't recall that having reached here.
Well, it did eventually, and has been an important industry throughout the Galician coast right up to the present day. Anyway, now we are going to go right and follow the path that skirts around the beach and leads towards the port. All right?
Yes, of course.
Here on the beach, in your day, there were fishing boats.
Indeed there were, but just small ones. People used to go fishing mainly in the summer. In the winter, the boats were brought up onto dry land until the following spring.
What the older fishermen have told me is that they could fish near the coast and set these huge traps built with eucalyptus poles.
I don't remember that. I'm not sure if it's because my memory failed me or perhaps that type of fishing gear didn't exist in my day. Anyway, I never saw a eucalyptus tree in my life. What about all those houses? What were they for?
Originally, they were fishermen's huts used to store the fishing gear. If you look to the left, you can see a couple of them that were made out of stone.
It's true that there didn't used to be any houses here that people lived in, because they tended to live further inland, maybe 1 or 2 kilometers away. What I do remember is seeing the nets stretched out to dry.
What some of the locals told me is that the job of the family that owned that stone hut was to sew and repair the nets. And I suppose they could also have been in charge of dyeing the nets too. Do you know what I mean?
My knowledge isn't as broad as you think, Sierra, my friend. And although I lived in Chobe and Viveiro, I don't know everything about the fishermen's customs.
When we get to the end of the path, we are going to head right along a tarmac track which leads down to the port.
Okay.
Dyeing the nets was a process that enhanced their conservation. It isn't done anymore, but up until the 1960s, the nets were made from thread. And to make them more resistant, they were put in boiling water with the bark of pine and other trees, which gave them a distinctive brown color. The dyeing was carried out in vats, initially made of stone, but later in metallic recipients and drums.
And that huge esplanade? I don't recognize it at all.
You wouldn't. It's the new quay, and it's all on land reclaimed from the sea. Would you like to walk down to the end?
I'd love to.
Okay, come on then. Turn towards the left and continue walking along the quay until you get to a small stone wall at the end. Look, those bundles covered by nets on tarpaulin over there on the right, at the edge of the quay, are the pots.
Interesting fishing gear.
They are for catching octopus and velvet crabs, spider crabs, lobster.
People didn't really eat seafood back in my day, except for lobster maybe.
Look, from here you get a much better view of that corroded building that you were asking me about earlier. Can you see it over there, slightly to the right? All that is the Alumina Aluminium Industrial Complex. The corroded buildings belong to the aluminium oxide factory. And on the right is the aluminium factory. Cervo is where the aluminium oxide is made, and Chauvet, the aluminium. They are separated because the process to obtain aluminium has two phases. First, the aluminium oxide is obtained from bauxite, a mineral imported from Guinea Conakry, and it's earthy in color. It then undergoes an electrolytic process, which consumes a huge amount of energy, and by means of which the aluminium oxide is transformed into aluminium.
That's alchemy for you. If that factory had existed near me in my lifetime, then I might have been able to use that material for my balloon ship project, which others who came after me did. In my time, aluminium was considered a precious metal, almost as expensive as gold.
The industrial use of aluminium began around a decade after your project design, when a Hungarian inventor, David Schwartz, suggested using it to coat his airship, an idea which would then be copied by Count Zeppelin. Let's walk over to the stone wall at the end of the quay. We'll make a stop at the plaque. You'll see where that small breakwater veers off to the right.
Yes, I think we need a stop. When did you say the factory opened?
It started operating in 1979, although it was some time later before the complex as a whole was operational.
So it was exactly 100 years after I finished my project on air navigation.
How true! We hadn't stopped to think about such a coincidence. Poetic justice, I suppose.
Tell me something, though. Did it take years to build the factory? And did it require many construction workers?
Not as many as you might think. It took around 4 years to build. And thousands of people were taken on to work on its construction from all over Galicia, as well as from Asturias and Castilla, and from as far away as Cape Verde. When everything was up and running in 1980, 2,733 workers were employed directly. It had a tremendous social and economic impact throughout Almería.
If I understood you correctly, you said before that the process to obtain aluminium required a lot of energy. And looking at the size of the factories, I just can't imagine how they could have produced so much.
When I say energy, I mean electricity.
I think I understand basically how it's produced and transported, but that doesn't mean I understand all the different ways in which it can be obtained.
Well, the proposal was that there could be two main sources of electricity supply to the Alumina Aluminio Complex. On the one hand, it could come from a large thermoelectric plant 45 kilometers away in As Pontes. And on the other hand, in order to guarantee a long-term supply of electricity, plans were being drawn up for a nuclear power station that could be located on the Rego de la Esplanade in Portocelo.
My dear friend, I think I understand the basics of electricity, but anything related to nuclear energy remains a mystery to me.
That doesn't matter, but you should know that at the time, there was significant social opposition to nuclear power plants. because of the danger they posed. There was a historic demonstration attended by around 10,000 people who marched from Viveiro to Chove to protest against the opening of the plant. In the end, it wasn't built.
I don't understand. In my time, scientific and technological progress was universally celebrated.
Maybe society was beginning to learn from its mistakes and realize that progress had to have limits. At any rate, and without nuclear energy, 20 years later, this was the third largest aluminium production plant in the world. And then it was sold to one of the sector's most important multinationals, the American company Alcoa, which ended up in possession of Spain's entire aluminium industry, previously state-owned. In time, it could be the only aluminium factory in service in the whole of Spain. But it was under great strain to continue operating, partly because of how expensive electricity was.
So, if my calculations are right, it was only operational for 40 years. It seems to me that things move very quickly in your world. And what will they do with all of this when it can't operate anymore?
Good question. One to which I don't have the answer. Maybe in the future, there'll be some kind of recovery plan, like the one for the wheel processing plant. But let's change the subject. Here, on our left, is a stone wall at the end of the quay. Do you see it? Just a little further back, on the left.
Yes, I can see it. It's the only stone wall there is. It looks as if it was part of some older construction, but I can't remember anything like that right here.
They're part of an old shellfish farm whose tanks were in the sea. Now it has a concrete cover, but it used to be made out of wood. And you can see the pool right at the end.
Why did they need such a big pool?
The fishermen brought the seafood here to keep it alive.
So eating seafood goes back a while.
Well, this fish farm must have been built in the 1950s. But the wheel processing plant we saw earlier, well, it must have begun operating in 1965, forcing the fish farm to cease its activities because the blood and the blubber it produced contaminated the water in the entire bay. We'll walk back and I can continue the story. We have to go all the way back along the quay. Come on.
I'm not sure I should venture a guess, but from what I can tell, what happened to the fish farm also happened soon afterwards to the whale processing plant, which had to close when the aluminium factory was set up here.
That's true. And it could appear that we don't learn from our mistakes. But you'll agree with me that working on the land or at sea is tough. And people were glad of other types of work which paid better as well, such as in the wheel processing plant or the aluminium factory.
I do indeed agree with you. Industrial progress was a dream in my day. Seeing how it came true 100 years later in my birthplace is a privilege. Although, what I see in front of me isn't how I imagined it.
There were protests because when all of this coastline passed into the hands of alumina, the continuation of the fishing industry was endangered. It took more than 20 years for the port to boast the facilities you can see today.
So some things can be done very quickly, like building an aluminium factory, but others take more time, like introducing improvements to a small port.
Now you're beginning to understand how the wall works today. After that, the blasting to extract stone began.
You've really lost me now. Blasting. Extracting stone. From where? For what?
I'll answer all your questions. But first, let me just say that when we get to the end of the port, we are going to go up the hill on the right, all the way to the top. All right?
All right, but not too fast, please.
Going back to your question, I know it isn't easy to understand, or maybe I'm just going too quickly. a lot of stone needed to be extracted as quickly as possible in order to build the breakwaters. So that's why there was so much blasting. What happened was, although it's hard to believe, that when the aluminium factory was designed, nobody thought about the breakwaters. Even when one of the most important requirements involved was that the bauxite could be unloaded in the port in any type of weather.
How could they forget something as important as that at the planning stage?
In those days, things were planned with little regard for the consequences. In this case, the original idea was to build the complex in Villa García, in the Arosa area, where the sea is much calmer and there wouldn't have been a need for breakwaters.
So why did they end up building it here?
Wait, when we get to the top of the hill, we have to turn left, all right? Further ahead is a place that has something to do with precisely that. When it became known that the factories were to be built in Villa García, the people there began to kick up a fuss because they believed that one of the richest and most productive areas in Galicia could be ruined. So another location had to be found, and that was here in Moras and San Cibrao. There was an urgent need to build the breakwaters in the bay. Initially, it was thought that one breakwater could be enough, but in the end, two were necessary, each around a kilometer long. Look, we are going to stop there to the right of that wooden platform in front of the information panel.
Perfect. So I assume that those strange formations just ahead of us are in some way linked to what we were talking about?
Absolutely, but one step at a time. By the way, there's a bench over there if you want to sit down.
I wouldn't say no. I get quite tired from time to time, and I need a rest at the moment.
So, as I was saying, there were two breakwaters, each of them measuring a kilometer in length. They had to be built as quickly as possible. Among the different solutions proposed, the best one involved protecting the breakwaters by using thinner blocks than the usual ones. Those are the concrete blocks you can see over there on the right. They are called dolos.
So those odd-shaped blocks were placed on the breakwater to protect it from the power of the sea?
They were chosen precisely for their shape. The double inverse T-shape enables them to be interwoven so that when the waves strike, the water is dissipated and loses strength. More decisively, dolos were chosen because they can be manufactured more quickly and they weigh less than the cube-shaped blocks normally used, meaning that they can be handled and moved much more easily.
And why have they been put there, in that circle?
Some of these have been put there as if to form a part of an open-air exhibition. The circle is the remains of what used to be the Dolos factory. To speed up the process, it was set up here, near the North Breakwater. A huge crane was placed at the center of the circle, around which molds were filled with concrete. Some hours later, the concrete was removed from the molds and the blocks were moved from the circle by the crane, which had a range of more than 15 meters. They could remain there for almost a month before being transported and deposited on the breakwater.
So it was more kind of on-site factory, like a part of a military operation to supply the battlefront.
That's one way of looking at it, and not too far removed from reality. Between 1976 and 1979, some $18,000 were produced, each one weighing 53 tons, with a speed being of essence. $160 were put in place daily. This information panel gives you lots more information, but now we need to continue our walk. And if you want, we can come back here and look at it in more detail later. I want to take you now to what is known as the Dolos Cemetery.
I'll gladly go with you to such an unusual cemetery, and I'm guessing it is not a literal description, but a rhetorical way of calling it.
Yes, and you'll see why. If you're looking at the circle of Dolos in front of you, you have to turn to the right and walk back along the same track we took to get here.
All right, I'll stand up and we can start walking back. I mean, if they worked at such a pace and managed to produce so many Dolos back in the day, it must have been like a well-oiled machine of mixers, cranes, boats, and goodness knows what else.
The locals tried to put up with all the upheaval of the work site as best they could. On the one hand, the blasting, on the other, the vibrations when they started making the Dolos here, and the constant coming and going of lorries, too.
Please excuse my ignorance, but was this where Dolos were invented? I never heard such a word or remember it being mentioned at all, insofar as geometry was concerned.
Before I answer that, let me just say something. When you get to the junction, turn left. The odd car might pass, so stay on the left-hand side. Now. Ah, yes. You couldn't have known what Dolos were, because they were designed in 1963 by two South African engineers. They were first used for the breakwater at the entrance to East London Port, in the southeast of the country. The name comes from Afrikaans. It would seem that the word Dolos refers to bones used in certain traditional medicine practices, as well as for children's toys.
Isn't it strange that this industrial complex would end up having links to Africa? Workers that came from Cape Verde. Voxite brought in from Guinea. Dolos invented in South Africa.
Careful, we are just coming to the junction. Cross the tarmac track and go straight ahead along the dirt track. Watch out for cars. You're not used to having to do that.
I'll be careful crossing, don't worry. Look, at the beginning of the track, there's a signpost with quite a lot of signs. Let's see what they say. Straight ahead is Portocelo.
Tomás, we can't stop here. We have to keep going. This path forms a part of the Cantabrian Nature Route. Here, it shares some sections with Chauvet's Coastal Path, an 18-kilometer stretch conditioned by the council and which runs the length of the coast as far as the beach at Porto Novo. Look, from that little opening there on the right, you can see the breakwater from the outside.
I'm going to stop for a moment to get a good look. It's impressive indeed. But not as much as the powerful Cantabrian Sea itself. Okay, that's enough. No, don't look at me like that. I'll keep on walking. Before the breakwater was built, the waves crashed against the shore mercilessly because there were no defenses.
That's true. When the sea is rough, it's just the salsero, or foam, that passes over the top.
I've heard you say that word, salsero, a few times, and I have to say, I'm not familiar with it.
We say salsero when there's a storm at sea and the waves crash against the rocks, creating a white foam. Salsero.
I like it. It certainly illustrates the phenomenon, not just because it evokes the image of the foam, but for the way it sounds, imitating the noise of the waves breaking. I like it too because it takes some of the drama out of the storm. I don't know about now, but in my day, storms and gales were the cause of many deaths at sea. I remember the gales on Holy Saturday of 78, as if it were yesterday. That's 1878, of course.
Look, when you pass by those Dolos on the right, on the horizon you can see Os Farallos, three little islands in the distance. Let's stop a moment to get our bearings. The highest one, on the left, is called Opé, the foot. The one in the middle, A Sombriza, the shadowy island. And the one on the right is A Baixa, the low one. Let's keep walking. I couldn't want you to get lost. We are now standing on land reclaimed from the sea. This track was made to provide access for the lorries that moved the dollars. And loads of rubble were deposited on the original coastline, some of whose stretches were lost.
From what I can see, the dollars ended up everywhere.
The ones that we can see on the track were taken out of the breakwater because they broke up, not long after they'd been put in place. 3 or 4 years, maybe, they began to break up and had to be replaced with cube-shaped blocks. These breakages and mass of dollars in different places around the world raised concerns about their validity, bringing about a radical change in the way of designing and analyzing breakwater resistance.
Lessons were learned here then. Not all is lost in this world of yours.
Before we get to the Dolos Cemetery, we have to pass the Baleeira Beach. We can take a look for a moment if you like.
Of course, and if it isn't taking us out of our way, then I'd be very happy to take in some unspoiled landscapes, even if it's just for a moment.
All right. A little further along, there's a fork in the track. When we come to it, we are going to take the one that hits right and follows the coast towards the Moraes Cliffs, which you can see at the far end. You'll see there's the track leading off to the left, climbing quite steeply, which belongs to Xove Coastal Path. If we were to follow that one, we could come to a place called the Atalaya, or Watchtower. It's a name linked to whale hunting, and there are many others like it along the coast. Another one exists here in Xove, called Coto da Vela, which might also refer to a lookout post. Remember that where the path branches off into two, we are going to take the path on the right. Good. Tomás, you said that you were aware Xove had a whaling tradition, didn't you?
I did. And I recognize all of those place names. Here is Baleeira Beach, and further up, the Atalaya. And a little further along, Coto da Vela.
To get to the beach, we have to look for a lane that goes off to the right. Can you see it? Make sure you haven't already passed it. Good. More or less straight away, you can see Os Farallós and the tip of the North Breakwater.
This isn't easy, especially with these shoes you call trainers. My feet are killing me. But never mind, I love these country lanes.
Just ahead, it becomes a stone path, and it gets a bit wider too. You don't need to go any further. Look for a spot on the right, from where you can see the Pebble Beach. That's Baleeira Beach. Its shape is completely different today because the stone and rubble removed when the quarries opened were deposited here. At the top of the beach, there was some sand, but the action of the sea washed it all away over time.
Although it might not seem like it, this port was a place of refuge used for whale hunting. I didn't know it as such, but I've heard stories about it. It's said that on that hill above the cliff, where the Atalaya is, and before you reach Sarong Island, there used to be a hut which would have served as a shelter for the watchmen, whose job it was to keep an eye out over the sea at all times. When they saw a whale blow near the coast, they would light a fire with some gores so that the smoke could be seen for miles around. Alerted to its presence, the whalers would launch their boats with 8 men aboard each one, ready to chase the whale and capture it.
Well, after the little bit of history, We can get back to our work. We'll go back along the lane to the truck. Don't worry. It's not much longer now.
And that's all there was. Some said it was the pig of the sea, because nothing from Wales went to waste. The blubber and the meat was of primary importance. The bones were used to make tools, and if there were any parts that would eventually go off, they were used to fertilize the vegetable gardens.
Okay, now we are back on the dirt track. If we want to go to the Dolos Cemetery, we have to head right.
Let's do it. For someone in my condition, there's no better way to finish a walk than in a cemetery, even if it's a cemetery of inert elements made by man.
Your balloon ship was an inert element made by man.
But an aerostatic balloon is nothing more than a type of machine that, by containing a space full of gas that's lighter than oxygen, rises up into the air until it finds a balance. A machine made by man to merge with nature.
It's all too clear that you lived at a time before the industrial boom. Yours is an unspoiled gaze which has now been lost. My aim on this work was to show you the staggering ability of humanity to change the world. A phenomenon that gathered peace in the years you were here on Earth. For you, as well as for others of that time, trust in the goodness of technical and scientific advances meant investing absolute hope in the future. And this is a part of such hope for the future. We've reached the Dolos Cemetery now. We can either stay here or walk among them if you like. But our walk ends here. What do you think?
This is a fantastic place. If I didn't know all I do now, after everything you've told me, the existence of these structures would be beyond my comprehension. But knowing why so many of them ended up here, and the mishaps they suffered, only to be rejected and unable to fulfill their role of protecting the breakwaters, this place seems to me more like an archaeological site than a cemetery. Piled up like that, they look like skeletons from a civilization yet to be studied.
I never seen the Dolos in that way, like objects of a future archaeology. What an interesting idea, Thomas. Now, it's getting a little late, but continuing along this track and a little further ahead, you'll come across the morass cliffs. They are now known as the paper cliffs, from the shapes left by the erosion of the rock. It makes for yet another puzzling, yet wonderful landscape. One forged not by human intervention, but by the power of nature. I'll take you there another day to show you that we also have a coast unspoiled by man in shoving.
This is where our walk ends. Thank you for accompanying us. As with Thomas, we would invite you to visit the paper cliffs. Just a 5-minute walk further along the track. A narrow path which climbs up among the stones will take you there. Please be careful. You'll be able to enjoy some spectacular views. On the one hand, the open sea and the rocks polished by the wind and the sea until they adopt the fragile appearance of paper. On the other, the Dolos Cemetery, seen from another angle.
The characters in this audio guide were played by Order of Intervention by Patricia De Lorenzo, Manu Fernandez, Dani Trillo and Xavi Romero. Recording by Tomás Aceitos. Editing and sound post-production by Jacobo Martínez Antelo and documentation, script and direction by Jesús Ron. This guide would not have been possible without the collaboration of Benigno Rapa García and Lucía Sánchez Meitín, or without reading Tomás Mariño's manuscript titled Project on Air Navigation.